Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
In June 1991, in Orange County, California, 23-year-old Denise Huber mysteriously vanished on her way home from a concert. Her car was found the next day, but there was no trace of Denise. Her disappearance would remain unsolved for 3 years, until reports of a suspicious vehicle would turn a missing person case into a murder investigation following the discovery of a freezer and its grisly contents. This is what happens when a monster's hoarding mentality leads to his downfall. This is the case of the Icebox Killer. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one of those where, even though it is just unbelievably tragic, of course it is, there's also a part of me that just loves the fact that sometimes human intuition and instinct is just so spot on, and we're just taught to ignore it all the time, aren't we? In fact, get this, during my career, I actually once put online that I felt that intuition was as powerful as any academic knowledge, and I literally had a complaint sent to my governing body that they took seriously. They were like, instinct, intuition, that doesn't exist. And you're thinking, how can the British Psychological Society not understand that we are animals and we are connected to these things? But hey, sometimes academics and intellects like to think they're far more clever than the whole amazing human condition of what makes us truly incredible, which is our animal instinct as much as our human conscience. But just throwing it out there, this is going to example that sense of instinct sometimes, the fact that sometimes we just realize there is something off about a situation, and acting on that can genuinely change the world. Let's go back to 1991. This is in Orange County, California. We've got 23-year-old Denise Annette Huber. She's living with her parents, Ione and Dennis Huber. She's also got a brother who's living with them, and they live on Vista Grande in Newport Beach. Denise was known to be a really happy, really fun-loving young person. Apparently she had a huge fondness for frogs, which is something that I love. I just think out of all the beautiful creations in this world, frogs are probably a very overlooked one, apart from in France, where people do consider them relatively delicious. But anyway, everybody's got their own particular ideas of what is good cuisine. I find it a little bit weird. But nonetheless, for her, frogs signified and symbolised something lovely. She was also known to be the life and soul of the party. She was somebody who really enjoyed travelling. She was quite cultured. She loved music, reading, water skiing, so she was athletic. She was a huge fan of the Los Angeles Kings hockey team. And it's also worth noting that she was somebody who had some very strong religious convictions. And the description that I've just given you there, I think, is a very holistic description of an individual who's living life fully. She's interested and intrigued by so many things, and she's connected to so many things, you know, both socially and on a spiritual level. Those who were around her said that it was clear from the get-go that she was always going to be a very sensitive, very caring and compassionate individual. She loved her parents. She's incredibly close to them. She was often known to go for lunch or to the beach with her mother. They enjoyed those days away. And then every Friday morning, Denise and her father would sit down and have breakfast date. They'd just sit together. They'd just spend time talking, just have that quality experience of one-on-one time. Her friends even called her daddy's little girl, which I can relate to. I was daddy's little girl, and I absolutely celebrated every single second that I had with him when I was little, but also all the way through the years. It was just always such a joy to be one-on-one with him, because you feel like you've got this little pocket of paradise. And certainly for Denise, it seems to be reflective in her relationship with her dad. Let's go back to the 2nd of June, 1991. It's a Sunday. Now, this evening, Denise is going to a Morrissey concert. So we can also understand that she really did have great taste, because I am a diehard Smiths fan. And obviously, Morrissey was a key individual within that. So she was going to the Forum in Inglewood, California. And she was going with her boyfriend, Stephen Horrocks, because he brought them both tickets. They'd met around 6 months earlier where they worked. And they worked at a place called the Spaghetti Factory in Newport Beach. But unfortunately for Stephen, that night he had to work. So he didn't want her to miss out whatsoever. He sounds like a really nice guy. He wanted to make sure that she enjoyed that evening because he'd arranged it for them. So he asked a mutual friend of theirs, Robert Calvert, if he'd go with Denise instead. Robert happily agreed. And it was that Sunday that Denise picked him up at the home that he was in Huntington Beach. Now, he said that when she arrived, she was really dressed up that night. She looked fantastic. She's wearing a dress, black stockings, high heels. And he said, you know, she looked really attractive. And she was a really attractive girl. But he just noted that she'd really put the effort in. And as they were driving to the concert, they stop, as you do, because we all know how incredibly expensive it is to go anywhere where concerts are involved. You walk through the doors and suddenly the drinks prices require a second mortgage and a guarantor. But they are aware of this, and so they smartly decide that they're going to buy some orange juice, small bottle of vodka, and also they pick up a bag of pretzels because, you know, they want to have a bit of a drink before the concert. They want to get in the mood. And then they arrive at the venue. It's around 8 p.m. Apparently they stayed in the car, had 4 or 5 shots of vodka, and they had some orange, and then they basically took some beer when they were watching the concert as well. So they had quite a bit to drink. Then after the concert ends, that's around 11 p.m., they actually go to the El Paso Cantina on Pacific Coast Highway, which is in Long Beach. And this is where Denise has a couple more beers. In fact, they stay until it closed around 1:30 a.m. They'd obviously had a really good time. But even though it was getting late, they didn't want to stay out astronomically late because they both had work the next day. So they decided to call it a night. But all in all, it had been a really excellent evening. They'd had a great time. Denise dropped Robert back home just after 2 a.m. And then she's going to take the route back to her parents. But she never arrives home. In fact, this is the last time that she's ever seen alive. And the next day, when Denise's parents realise that she hadn't come home, they're immediately concerned. Her mother, Ione, calls Denise's best friend, Tammy Brown, because she's hoping maybe she's gone there. But Tammy literally has no idea where Denise was. It's completely out of character, this behaviour. So they're immediately deeply concerned. Tammy, because she knows this just isn't like Denise at all, she ends up ringing around friends, including Robert, who obviously had been with Denise the previous night at the concert, but none of them have seen her. Now, Tammy is so moved by this and so concerned about her best friend that she starts driving around. She just wants to see if she can spot any sign of her friend. And again, this is testament to the kind of character that we're talking about where Denise is concerned, because clearly, even though it's a very short period of time that she's been missing, everybody realises this isn't like her. And also the fact that her friend, her best friend, is just up and out straight away searching for her, it demonstrates the kind of connections that Denise was capable of. So she ends up driving up to Huntington Beach, and then on her way back to Newport Beach, this is around 10 p.m., she spots Denise's Honda. So it's parked on the shoulder of Highway 73. This is basically just minutes away from Denise's home. Now, looking at the car, her friend can see she's obviously suffered a blowout. There were skid marks leading up to the vehicle, and the rear passenger tyre was actually flat. But the thing that's missing from the scene is Denise. She isn't there. Now, Tammy immediately used a payphone, calls Denise's parents, alerts them to the fact she's found the car. They immediately set off, drive to where the daughter's car had been found, obviously are now frantic about the possibilities and potentials of what's happened. When they get to their daughter's car, Ione and Dennis notice that there are no lights on the car, inside or out, nor were the keys in the ignition. The battery had literally drained from the hazard lights being left on. And the first thing that they think about doing is immediately calling the police, and they get there pretty quickly. Now, the officer in charge of her disappearance, they establish pretty quickly that Denise must have left her car after getting the puncture, and they imagine that this would be to call for assistance because it was a near payphone, just not far away at all. It was actually visible from the car, and also the road was really well lit. So if you're going to have a blowout, it's not ideal, but the temperament, so to speak, in the local area is perfect for you. You know, the lights are on and the actual phone box is visible. So all should have ended well. But it seems like Denise didn't actually ever make it to the phone. It was like she had literally vanished into thin air. And it must be almost impossible to manage the brutality of that knowledge as a parent, to think, what on earth has happened to my child? They went to a Morrissey concert. Clearly the car got into some problematic experience, but what happened to my child? She's just literally disappeared. Now the police take this really seriously. They're obviously concerned that there might be some malevolence involved. So they have this big police search underway for Denise pretty quickly. I would say, from what I've read about this, Denise's parents had an almost immediate reaction to fearing the worst. They knew that she wasn't the kind of person that would ever just get up and leave without explanation. There was no problems at home. She was happy. And she wouldn't voluntarily, as far as they're concerned, disappear. So right from the get-go, their intuition is something very bad has played out. Family, friends, local people from the area, volunteer, all joining the search. They put flyers everywhere, all over the local area. There were messages plastered on billboards. They created bumper stickers that were handed out bearing messages, "Do you know where Denise is?" Even a banner plane was hired. The family even managed to get together and put a $10,000 reward for information. Bear in mind, this is a long time ago. You know, 1991 is a long period of time ago. That's quite a lot of money. And because they were just making such incredible efforts, you know, and this is testament to the family, that they are literally going above and beyond to get this information out there. The missing case becomes quite a national experience, so it gains a lot of national attention. But in spite of all this incredible hard work, this dedication, this commitment, this passion, in fact, by the family, the weeks turn into months. And the months sadly turn into years, and still there's no sign of Denise. And of course, after that kind of period of time, you're always dealing with the reality of a case growing cold. And that's what happens. There are no leads, no new information is turning up. It's as if Denise literally just disappeared. No one saw anything, heard anything, knows anything. And for her family, the case growing cold is just a constant reminder, in fact, of her absence, because there's no explanation whatsoever. Her parents are left with no closure. They have so many unanswered questions. And for the next 3 years, they left her room untouched. And oh my God, do I relate to that? Do I relate to that? That feeling of somebody of this enormous meaning and value not being present anymore, and the things that they touched last, the things that they held last, the objects that they moved last, the clothes that they wore last, they're things that are just so pivotally important because they remind you of the moment where everything changed. But you can.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Freeze it in time so you capture the moment that they were there before ultimately they were gone. So leaving it in that way is firstly preserving who she was, but also it speaks of that sense of maybe one day she'll come home. And if she comes home, I want her to walk into that room and know that everything has been left just as she left it, that no one's interfered. So let's move now to the 13th of July, 1994, Arizona. Bear in mind, this is 3 years after Denise's disappearance. Local paint shop owners Jack and Elaine Corr went to 37-year-old John Joseph Famolaro's house in a place called Yavapai County, which is in Dewey, Arizona. Now, Famolaro was actually a self-employed house painter, so they'd gone over to his home basically to buy some paint. But this is where instinct and intuition blows my mind. As they're leaving, Elaine can't help noticing something that she feels is really strange. Elaine reminds me of myself. Genuinely, deeply suspicious person. Can't help noticing things. You know what I say? Risk offending. It's always worth it. You might be seen as somebody who's a little bit of an interfering person, but it often pays dividends, and that is what is going to happen right now. So, as I said, they're leaving, and Elaine just can't help but notice this rider rental truck outside this guy's home. And immediately she's drawn to the fact that there's lots of weeds and grass that's grown around it. So she can see it's been there for a very long time. And this is a rental van. You know, the clue is in the title. It's a rental van. One of those things that you borrow for a short period of time and then you take back because it's a rental. You don't expect that anyone's hiring it for a few years. I'll just hire it for a few years. What the hell are you moving? I don't know. You never know, do you? One of those people, I gather a lot of stuff. It's best to have the rental outside for a few years. And even if you had rented something for a few years, it wouldn't have grass and weeds growing around it, would it? Like in some weird horror movie. So Elaine's thinking to herself, listen, why is a rental van parked there in this situation? It makes no sense, particularly when Famolaro had actually claimed to have moved to the property 6 months earlier. Also, another thing that really triggers her is there's an extension cord that leads from the truck into his home. And therefore, in her mind, she's thinking, what on earth is going on in that van? Why would you need electricity pumped into it? So something just doesn't sit right with her. And she literally said to the police later down the line that she felt a spirit pulling her towards the vehicle. So that sense of also being dragged there by something unearthly, so to speak. And initially, Elaine was thinking to herself, you know what, I think maybe this truck's been stolen, because why else would it be in that situation? And it bothers her. So she takes a note of the registration, and she goes ahead and she reports it to the police. I love Elaine. Elaine is one of those people that you just can't help but celebrate in this world, because it's people who notice these kind of things that make a difference to this world. So later that day, Yavapai County Police actually receive a radio call about a possible stolen vehicle. A check's been done on the license plate, and that had actually confirmed that Elaine was right. The truck had absolutely 100% been reported stolen. It had been taken from Orange County, California in January of 1994, from where Famolaro had moved 6 months earlier. This is getting curiouser and curiouser, isn't it? And on top of that, it had been rented for a day and never returned. Yeah. Literally 24 hours. And yet it's turned up 6 months later with overgrown reeds outside this guy's place. Now, when the officers arrive at the address, immediately they notice this 24-foot rental truck. Just going to throw it out there. How did he ever think he was going to get away with it? Like, just hope that the ivy would grow over it completely, as in some kind of Disney movie, only to be discovered 500 years down the line. You know, it's just ridiculous. But nonetheless, you'll understand a little bit more about this as I go into it. So it's parked by the side driveway of a corner house. And because it's obviously a stolen vehicle, it's not one that they need to get permission off the owner for, essentially, because they know it's been taken. They get this locksmith. And so this locksmith goes and opens the back of the truck. Now, initially what they see is loads of painting equipment. It's got loads of paint, loads of cans, loads of rollers. But they kind of notice straight away there's a chest type freezer and it's padlocked and it's also sealed with lots of tape. And if you think about a chest freezer, that's the last thing you're going to do. Hey, most of us are just storing our chips in there and a variety of different frozen meals that we can use at our leisure. We're certainly not going around padlocking them. In fact, literally, it doesn't matter who you are or where you are. If you walk into somebody's house and there's a padlocked freezer, you back out immediately and call law enforcement because you just know this is not going to end well, is it? There's no reason to padlock any freezer. Not even if you're very concerned that your children are greedy and that they will indeed find a way to get those extra portions without your knowledge. Even then, stay away from the padlock. Now, they notice this heavy-duty red extension cord, so they're able to see that it's actually plugged into this particular chest freezer, but it also goes from the back of the truck over a back fence and into Familaro's house. So you immediately have this connection. Familaro has chosen to keep this plugged in for a reason, and also it's indicative, therefore, that he's the owner of this particular chest freezer. Ain't going to be plugging in to somebody else's rental van, is he? Now, initially, because of the fact that the police are thinking this is really strange, and because they've got like large unmarked cans of paint, they thought it could maybe be a methamphetamine lab of some kind. So initially they call in the narcotics task force, and also the fire service actually come in and check whether there are any potential booby traps, because clearly if you are cooking meth, you're not gonna want law enforcement to find out. So it may be that you leave things that could explode. Anyway, turns out that this is not a mobile drugs lab at all. In fact, when the officers cut the lock on the chest freezer and they start removing the tape, they immediately know what they're dealing with because it hits them. It's that unmistakable smell of decaying flesh. And once the lid's open, an officer actually puts his hand in and immediately recoils because he feels like he can feel a human shoulder. So they are totally blindsided. Initially, they're thinking this is potentially some kind of drugs reality, and now they're realizing they're dealing with a body. They clear the area immediately, because obviously now it's a potential crime scene, and homicide detectives are immediately called to the scene, and they get very, very quickly. Now, when the contents of the freezer start getting examined, it's found to contain something that's just covered in a large black plastic bag. And the bottom of the freezer itself, they can see just when they're looking at it, it's covered in a layer of frozen blood as far as they're concerned, at least some kind of bodily fluid. Whatever they felt in the big bag, they did feel immediately had been there for a very long time because there were loads of ice crystals covering the inside of the freezer. But the detectives, of course, need to establish what is inside the bean bag itself. So they carefully cut through it because they don't want to disturb any of the information that they're going to need to take to court in the future, potentially. And as they cut through it, they find another black plastic bag. Beneath that, yet another. So this has been well wrapped. And it's when the detective cuts through the third bag, he's met with the most grisly sight. He sees the decomposing flesh of a human shoulder. So his instincts was right when he put his hand in. That's exactly what he was feeling. And when the plastic was actually removed further, it was revealed that there was a frozen human corpse. And that corpse was naked on its knees in a semi-fetal position. Head was tucked into its chest. Wrists were handcuffed behind the back. And at that point, of course, there was nothing to confirm the identity of the body. But it's clear, however, that person has died, has been against their will. It's obviously a homicide. But the way I've described it, you can tell the psychological fear and horror the last moments of that individual would have experienced would have been absolutely harrowing beyond belief. To be handcuffed in that situation, naked, it doesn't bear thinking about. Now, on top of the fact that there was no ID, nothing to actually tell us who this body was, there was also no things like blood splatter. So it was immediately clear that the person hadn't been killed in the freezer, but it was very obvious to the investigators that they were dealing with the body of a young woman. Now, the entire truck containing the chest freezer and all its contents is removed. They send it to the crime lab in Phoenix, Arizona for pathologists to study. They want to know exactly what's happened, how this murder has played out. Now, the handcuffs on the wrist had actually been applied so tightly, it wasn't even possible to get a finger beneath them. They literally had to be removed with bolt cutters. And getting the body from the chest freezer was really difficult as well because it had become frozen to the bottom of the freezer. And it also become frozen because the plastic bag that had been wrapped in had also got stuck to that as well. So it's very difficult because you want to preserve forensic evidence. You want to make sure that you're not destroying anything that's going to be really ultimately important during any kind of trial. But you also need to get the body out to make sure that you can examine it fully. Now, when the body was finally extracted, it was still completely frozen solid. And a pathologist actually had to use a hairdryer just to speed up the thawing process. Now, once the body could physically be manipulated, the pathologist was actually able to access the head. And this is where the way that person died becomes very clear. So first of all, the head had been covered in three white plastic bags. So when they removed these plastic bags, it was very quickly clear how she died. Her skull had been completely shattered. And it was also evident this had occurred whilst the plastic bags were still on her head, along with bits of skin tissue and hair. Pieces of the white plastic were actually stuck to the shards of her skull. And they also saw that there were small holes and slits in the plastic bags. So that's where the blows had actually been repeatedly inflicted. And her scalp was covered in large gaping lacerations. And they could actually see the bone fractures through these gaping lacerations because they were so big. Also, they found that there was grey duct tape covering her face, and this went from the top lip to the upper eyelids, which covered her nose and basically acted as a blindfold. Now, one of the things that really stood out for the pathologist and that they found really unusual initially was the fact that her mouth was open and it was actually forming an O shape. Now, normally the mouth of a cadaver is closed, but when they searched the white plastic bags, they actually found a balled up blood-soaked piece of cloth, and that was found that matched the shape of the mouth opening. So obviously that had been used to gag her while she was killed. And just the description alone is horrifying, isn't it? To be in such a vulnerable situation, totally helpless, and to have somebody so violently abusing you, and all the while you are handcuffed, and the rage that seems to be involved in this particular crime is just enormous. We're talking about somebody literally crushing somebody's skull, and we're doing it in a way where this individual can't fight back. So there's a real malice and malevolence in these actions. And when you think about a violent death, this has got to be up there, hasn't it? With some of the most violent types of murders that you can even comprehend. Now, obviously, they forensically take details, so fingerprints are taken from the body, and it doesn't take long. We find out what happened to Denise Hoover. 3 years after, they identify that this is the corpse that they're dealing with. Now, the pathologist has a real intuition that this looks like it could have been sexually motivated. They wanted to know whether there'd been some kind of assault before or after her death.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
So they do vaginal swabs and they reveal nothing, but anal swabs reveal the presence of degraded sperm cells. And again, when you think about brutality, that kind of sexual violation, any sexual violation, is obviously abhorrent and reprehensible. But there is something I think is very brutal about anally raping somebody. And for a woman, it's one of those situations that can be unbelievably painful, and the fact that it's humiliating and degrading as well, that is something that clearly suggests that he's enjoying, as far as when it comes down to the murder, that domination and power and humiliation. And whenever I think about people like that, I can't help but consider serial killers. They're the kind of individuals that play these things out. And what I've described about the way she's been murdered, it just feels like somebody who has prepped and planned and really taken time enjoying the situation that they have created. Now, at this point, of course, the investigators know that they have a murderer. So Familaro is arrested on suspicion of murder. And at this point, they search his house. Now, he is the only occupant of the three-bedroom property. When the police go in, the place is a real mess. So it's incredibly cluttered, and they can tell just by looking he's a hoarder. So it's filled with items, and they are organized and stacked in boxes. So he does have some order to it, but it's just very difficult to see the wood for the trees, essentially, because he's literally got everything crammed in. There are hundreds and thousands of pieces of paper, and these are things like receipts that date back to the 1970s. For those of you who don't know what hoarding is, it's on the OCD spectrum, so the obsessive compulsive spectrum. So whilst a lot of people associate obsessive compulsive disorder with being ritualistic and clean, what people don't realise is there is a subsyndrome of that, which is hoarding. And where hoarding is concerned, it means that the person's got a psychological condition where they connect with things that most of us would just want to throw away, wouldn't even consider keeping. But for those, there is a connection. There's a sense of, well, I'll need it one day. And it can be incredibly limiting. It can be very, very distressing. And even though other people look in and think, how could you live like that? For the person with a hoarding complex, it's more, how could I survive without it, if that makes sense? And for the most part, we would absolutely have complete empathy and sympathy with an individual who has OCD, whether it's the super tidy, ritualistic, or whether it's to do with what I'm talking about right now. The truth is, this individual requires absolutely no sympathy or empathy whatsoever. And I just think this is Mother Nature's way of creating a chink in this killer's armor, genuinely, because what I'm going to talk about is going to be the thing that leads to his downfall. So these receipts that are really old, these papers that are really old, and then investigators start to come across really, truly incriminating evidence. So in a shelf in the garage, police find two large cardboard boxes with the words Christmas written on them. And immediately, when they open the boxes, they are hit with that same smell of decay. And inside the boxes, they come across these big black bin bags, identical to the ones that they've been covering the body. And again, when they open those, the smell grows stronger. And inside they find more smaller boxes. And in these boxes, there are all these various items. This includes a woman's blood-stained jacket, a dress, some car keys. Another black bag in the box contains a black leather wallet. Inside were credit cards and a checkbook in Denise Huber's name. In another box, officers found items including a makeup mirror, compact, a set of keys that included a Honda key, and a pair of black high-heeled pumps. And several of the items were stained with blood. And another thing that I noticed straight away was the pumps were all scratched down the back of a heel. Now, Denise was an immaculate dresser. There was no way that she would ever have worn shoes in that kind of a state. So if you think about it in context, it looks immediately like she was probably dragged, probably fighting and trying to prevent herself being taken, but eventually using her shoes to try and stop herself, but then getting scarred and ripped because she was being dragged. Now, every single one of those items I've just talked about, they were all subsequently identified to belong to Denise. So he has literally been caught bang to rights with bloodstained material belonging to the victim that we're talking about. And all of those had apparently been in her possession when she'd vanished. And what makes it even more clear that we're dealing with the killer of Denise is all those clothes were confirmed to be the ones that she'd worn on the night that she disappeared. Now, on top of finding her clothes, I mean, this guy really has kept hold of everything, because they find a pair of men's jeans that match the size of other jeans in Familaro's wardrobe, along with a sweatshirt and surgical gloves. And these were also all covered in blood. So this is no doubt the clothing we're talking about when he murdered Denise. On top of that, and it is pretty astonishing, because yes, this guy's a hoarder, but arguably he's also a murderer. So even though this guy has hoarding OCD, you would still think that maybe a desire to escape would provide enough motivation to let go of certain items, but it just doesn't seem to have played out for him. Because they even find a bloodstained hammer and a nail puller in the boxes, along with a roll of grey duct tape that matched the tape used to blindfold Denise. So it's impossible for him to escape this reality. At the end of the day, everything connects the dots to him. Meanwhile, in Familaro's desk drawer, they find handcuff keys which unlocked the handcuffs on Denise's wrists. On top of a stack of newspapers, investigators found ones featuring headline stories about Denise's disappearance. So forensically, he's been following this. Other papers were found in the property which related to reports about Denise. One story actually concerned the anniversary of her disappearance and featured a picture of her parents at the location where the car had been found. And behind them, there was a billboard reading, "Have you seen Denise Huber?" alongside her image. He had collected all of those. Now, I appreciate we are dealing with somebody who has got a hoarding complex, but I am just having a lot of thoughts about serial killers again. What do serial killers do? They forensically follow investigations. They take great pride in picking up mementos. And essentially, it feels like, yes, there is a hoarder side to him, but also he's doing exactly what serial killers do. He's anchoring himself back to those moments. He's collecting things of meaning to him, which for him are the power, domination, and sadism that he elicited over his victim. Surely that's also got to be a connector. We're not just talking about a hoarder here. We're talking about a serial killer potential who also has hoarding issues. Because like I said, I think he gets great pleasure out of being able to look at these again and again and again. They even find a receipt for the chest freezer that was ordered on the 10th of June 1991. That's a week after Denise had disappeared. And on a videotape that they go through in Familaro's house, there's a segment from an episode of Inside Edition, which is a great program that was recorded, and it's a feature on Denise's disappearance. So he's collected all of this victim-based memorabilia. And police were also able to find paperwork pertaining to a warehouse in Laguna Hills, California, from where Familaro had operated his painting business back in 1991. At that time, he'd even been living there, so he'd converted one of the rooms into a bedroom. And the new occupants said, oh my God, when they moved in their own stuff, they had to have the place thoroughly and professionally cleaned because it was a real mess. And there was a particular large patch of what they thought was red paint, because obviously that was what he was doing there, so it was no big deal. It's just a massive area of red paint. But the forensic examination then went and investigated, and they found traces of human blood throughout the warehouse. You heard me, throughout the warehouse. That is just devastating to say, because when we're thinking about blood being everywhere, it has to draw a parallel with the way the person died. And we have to always keep at the center of the fact that what we're describing here is this incredible young woman's last moments. And her last moments must have been absolutely harrowing and terrifying and brutal. Now, in one particular area, when they investigate this particular place, sections of the drywall and wooden framing were saturated in dried blood. I'm using the word directly from the report. Saturated in dried blood. Oh my God. How must Denise's last moments have been? I mean, how must her family manage knowing this? I mean, they had their worst suspicions, they had their fears, but I don't think that you can ever envisage somebody that you love ending in a situation so dire. And it's incredible and testament to the investigators that they go so deep in this investigation and find this out. But every dot that joins together to create the guilt of this killer, it comes with such a heavy price. It comes with the price of the knowledge of the individuals who love her. And I imagine it was like their worst nightmare after nightmare after nightmare, just cataclysmically hitting them. Because of course, it starts off in one place in this van with a chest freezer, but every single step of the way, we're being informed more and more about just how horrific Denise's moments were as she took her last breaths. They take samples from everywhere, and they also take samples from the bloodstained items that are found in Familaro's home. And it is immediate to those investigating that there's no way that that could have come from Familaro. But pretty quickly they find that it is a match as far as the DNA profile of Denise is concerned. So they connect that this is Denise and that was Denise's blood. Now, investigators, they believe that because of the injuries to the head, she died from some type of blunt force trauma. They believe that she was struck at least 31 times. And they believe that that was 14 direct blows and 17 glancing blows. So obviously the 14 direct blows doing the major damage and the 17 glancing blows being more maybe a miss, just a kind of graze. But what kind of a frenzy is somebody in to act in that manner? And they are honest in the report. They say that even though that's what they've pulled out, there could have been many, many more. And they said the reason for this is it could have just been fractures on top of fractures. So, you know, hitting the same area again and again. And they're able to quickly connect the fact that the injuries are consistent with the nail puller and the hammer, which had been found at Familaro's property. So they have every piece of information and detail required to make sure that Familaro is going to go down. I mean, this is a watertight case, isn't it? Now, they often, in these cases, do historical records regarding the experiences of previous partners because they're trying to create a picture of the kind of person they're dealing with. This human predator, they want to know what have they been like in their past relationships. So they actually speak to ex-partners of Familaro, and both of the partners that they speak to said he absolutely loved humiliating them. So I'll give you an example. One of them went on holiday with him. This was in New York City for her birthday, which sounds lovely. Who would not want to go to New York City for a birthday? And you know, you're in a relationship and you think you're gonna have a great time with your partner. And they were in the hotel room, they're playing around as you do. So he'd been tickling her and then her nightgown just slips down and it feels like this is the trigger. And he gets more excited and starts getting really rough. And she said, like, suddenly out of nowhere, she finds herself handcuffed to a bar across the hotel window. And then he proceeds to rip off her nightgown, opens the curtains, walks out of the hotel room laughing, and just leaves her there for hours, naked, in full view. I mean, what kind of sadist acts in that manner? Because she's saying humiliation, but that is very sadistic. That is non-consensual violation sexually. To leave her there helpless, vulnerable, naked, in front of a window where anybody can look in, and he's enjoying knowing that. I would imagine he was probably watching from a distance, because it's that power, it's that control, it's that knowing that he's dominated her. Now, she doesn't stay in the relationship after that. Once she gets back to California, she ends it. And you think to yourself, oh, this is where so many women make mistakes. This isn't me blaming her at all. She did nothing wrong. But this is where so many women feel that somehow they're part of the problem, that they're maybe to blame. So they don't actually go and talk to law enforcement, because what happened there is a serious sexual violation. And he should have been charged because of that. But the chances are she felt, well, I consensually went there. He probably played it down and made her feel like it was just a silly joke. And in the end, you kind of second guess yourself and think, oh, maybe I'm overreacting. And you put your own needs down, as opposed to realizing that you were a massive victim in that situation. But so often women do this. They feel like they don't have a right to complain when somebody has violated them. And unfortunately, because of that, these kind of predators continue their behavior because there are no consequences given to them. Like I said, she did nothing wrong. It's more the way our society has sexualized women to such a point that when these horrible violations happen, so many of us choose not to act on them because we feel that we're the ones who've done something wrong. Then there was another ex-partner, and she described how she basically called it his house, and they were chatting away in the bedroom and they started to kiss. But at this point, she said, look, I've got to go. Now, it seems when she says, look, I've got to go, a switch flips. It really does. Like, her electing to say, I'm leaving, that gives him this sense of, well, I'm going to make the decision when you leave. You're not just going to voluntarily walk out of here unless I allow you to do so. So again, that sadistic mindset. So then he pushes her forcibly onto the bed. She actually hits her head on the back of a bookcase behind, so she gets really hurt. Then he climbs on top of her, manages to handcuff her wrists above her head, and then he forces her legs apart and pushes her shorts down with his foot, which, with respect, sounds like something he's done on many occasions. Can we be real here? This does not feel like his first rodeo. It doesn't. It feels like this is an individual schooled in how to violently assault and sexually assault women, because he's got that down to a T. And she said one of the most terrifying parts was that all the while he was doing it, he was just intensely staring into her eyes. And again, when you think about psychopaths, one of the things that they are very capable of is just like staring you down. In fact, what we know about psychopaths who lie is that because obviously they've not got the emotional cogency and understanding of an average human being who's well adjusted, they believe that if you sometimes look at somebody intensely, they will believe that you're being honest, because you know the more that you make eye contact, the better it is for honesty. But it's not true. Actually, the more that you stare at somebody intensely, the more disconcerting it can be and uncomfortable it can be. And actually, it's a sign of dishonesty when somebody does it in an overwhelming and over-the-top way. But equally, when you are thinking about hurting somebody, intensely looking into their eyes is such a power dynamic, isn't it? You want to see the fear, you want to see the terror, you want to see them looking upset, you want to know that you're causing that pain. And for her, having that done, it feels so distinct how other human beings have treated her, and she recognizes it. And she actually just immediately says to him, look, just go ahead, do it, but I'm going to tell the police. And she's distressed and crying when she says that. But she lets him know, you know, there's going to be a consequence to this. I am going to go to the police and report you for rape. And apparently at that point, his demeanor changes. He gets off her. He releases her from the handcuffs, calls her a bitch, and tells her she had brought it on herself. How many times do we hear that line trot out? It's just one of those scenarios, isn't it? Victim blame. You were kissing me. You were being a prick tease. All I did was act on your behavior. And even though it's completely incongruent with the truth, that kind of impact for women is often something that puts you on the back foot and makes you question yourself. Maybe I am to blame. Maybe I did lead him on. And to add insult to injury, he then storms out of the room. And again, that's so powerful because you're going to be there thinking, this guy has just hurt me because I banged my head badly when he pushed me back on the bed. He's handcuffed me. He's pulled my clothing off and violated me. But now he's telling me it's my fault and he's storming from the room. So even his behavior is blameful towards her. And that is so confusing for a victim. And that's why I do not think for one minute this is not an individual who has been a sexual predator for a long time. I think this guy is responsible for many, many rapes because he just seems so schooled, firstly, in how to actually trap a woman, but secondly, how to manipulate that woman into feeling that she is the person doing something wrong. Now, investigators go ahead and look into Bamalara's past as well. So aside from the relationships, they want to kind of draw up a pen portrait of who this guy is. They find out that he was raised in Santa Ana, California. He was raised with his older sister, Marion, and his brother, Warren. Now, his father was reported to be a very kind, very loving man, but his mother was not a very nice person at all. In fact, Anne was a very dominant force in the family. She was very controlling, and she was said to be frequently abusive to her husband. Also, she seemed to have a particular enjoyment of beating her sons with a belt as punishment. Now, I know in the 70s and 80s, people growing up will say, well, that was actually a form of corporal punishment that happened even in schools. So there was a climate, shall we say, of child abuse that was accepted. It's absolutely bonkers. I mean, literally, at no point in my entire parenting experience have I been like, oh, well, my child has misbehaved. Go and collect my belt. I mean, honestly, I'm laughing because it's just incredulous to me. Whoever thought that was okay? Whoever was like, you know what I need to do to that small child? I need a very strong leather belt, ideally with a very heavy metal clip where I can whip them with it. I mean, genuinely, how was this ever accepted in our society? But it was, wasn't it? So I'm just...
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Noting that on a cultural level, it's not as it is today back then, but still very severe to be beating your kid with a belt. Also, they were a very religious family. They were Catholic, and Anne seemed to grow with age more fanatically religious. Also, she became highly politicized. She was this staunch conservative, and her style of parenting was what we would call highly inconsistent. And that's a big problem because it means that a child can't really fundamentally find where the security lies. And we want kids to feel safe in their environment. And of course, if you have a parent who one day makes you feel that you're loved and cared for and takes you to Disneyland, and then all the time she beats you for a completely unprovoked reason, or she ignores you for days, you just can't find a consistency in the relationship. And it's really blindsiding and upsetting. And certainly he was a victim of this. Also, he was a sickly child. And this led to him being bullied. He was picked on by other kids. And apparently he and his siblings never actually played with other kids in the neighborhood. And the reason for that was they mainly were embarrassed because they didn't want other kids to come and see the house. It was just piled high with loads of rubbish. It had papers, laundry, because Anne was a hoarder. And it feels like that trait is something that Bamalara later inherits. Also, just to talk about the dysfunction within the family, when Marion, his sister, was around 11 years old, her brother Warren, and he was about 18 months older than her, he tried to sexually touch her on multiple occasions. So there is some really incestuous, inappropriate behaviour going on. And of course, Anne, being this major Catholic, she never wanted to discuss sex at all. But it's clear that she had a really inappropriate obsession with her son's sexual development. So, I'll give you an example. They would go to bed at night, and then she would burst in on them. And the whole reason and motivation behind bursting in on them was she wants to catch them masturbating. So then she could obviously berate them for that behavior or shame them for that behavior. Also, when they start to date girls, as they would, she would literally listen in on their telephone conversations. She'd also follow them when they left the house. So she's tracking what she sees is their sexual development and sexual potential, which is just absurd, creepy, and beyond odd. And again, the messages that that's giving the boys are very strange messages. When you are developing through pubescence, you actually want people to be able to have honest and open constructive conversations with you. Yes, it's a little bit embarrassing at times, but it's also really helpful because you've got questions and you don't want to ask him hates. Nobody wants to ask their friends. I absolutely remember somebody when I was 11 telling me that the correct name for pubic hair was a Herdwick. A Herdwick. I'm glad I didn't run with that because apparently it's a sheep. I can remember in all truth and honesty that girl saying it to me as if she knew some kind of special power, knowledge. And it turned out, fortunately, I didn't run with that particular phrase and start suggesting that I needed to shave my Herdwick, shall we say. Not that that was the problem at 11. Anyway, but you can tell that this is problematic. She's absolutely, overwhelmingly inappropriate. And we have developing children who are trying to find their way in the world, and it's going to distort that way. Now, Falamaro, he became a teenager who would switch between these periods of mania and also periods of depression. And he also goes on to develop a facial twitch, just like his mother. So there's some real comparisons there. And he also starts his hoarding behavior of taking magazines, papers in his room and storing them up like his mother does. Now, whether that's nature, or whether that's nurture, whether it's a combination of both, what we can say is something went very wrong in the developing minds of the Falamaro brothers. And I'll tell you why. Aside from what we're talking about right now, which is evident of Falamaro and his distortion and dysfunction, as an adult, Warren, his brother, is actually convicted of child sex offences. He ends up getting committed to a hospital as a mentally disordered offender. And Falamaro obviously had gone on to become a rapist and a murderer. And that is just terrifying. And don't get me wrong, we all know that psychopaths are believed to be hardwired. They're always going to end up this way. But the argument about a sociopath is that surely there'll be predispositions to their potential behaviours and predatory experience, but there are also activators. And certainly a massive activator would be this dysfunctional mother who had very few boundaries and had deeply problematic relationships with her sons. And also, you can't help thinking when describing the death that we've looked at today so far, the rage is there. What he did to his poor victim was literally destroy her skull, as well as the sexually motivated horror that she endured. It was the repeated hitting with the hammer, etc. And that just speaks to me of just this resentment and anger and rage that Falamaro had towards women. And does that live within his experience where his mother is concerned? Now, when it comes down to Falamaro getting charged, obviously he's charged with first degree murder, of course he is, but also they include two special circumstances of kidnapping and sodomy, which is absolutely bang on. Say it as it is. Now, obviously, murder in first degree is the most important one. That's the one that's going to cause the biggest sentence. That's the one that's got the hugest consequences. But let's just call it as it is. It's so important for our victims to get this kind of justice. And she was kidnapped and she was sodomized. And that needs to be known because the violation there is absolutely huge. And I always think that when killers only get one charge brought, because sometimes that will happen, the defense and prosecution agree that they're just going to deal with one major charge because that's going to be the one with the biggest repercussions. In this case, I think it's so powerfully important for the victim to be heard and a legacy of her suffering to be known. And those two extra charges are so important. We get to the point where he has to give a plea, obviously. Bearing in mind all the stuff I've told you, he says to the investigators that he is not guilty. Of course he does. I'm not guilty. Oh, at this point, is it not possible to just wheel him, I don't know, handcuffed to a chair, into his home with a lot of papers on a very dry day and drop a cigarette and just see what plays out? That would give use to a lot of the hoarding over the years, because genuinely, he says not guilty. How are we even in a position where this kind of lunacy can exist? What universe does this human predator exist in? Universe, everything that I say is bullshit. That's the kind of universe, isn't it? Because when it comes down to it, he is 100% bang to rights. You know, like, if I was the defense, I'd be like, you can't say that you're not guilty. I am not guilty, but you can't say it, but I'm going to say it. Why are you going to say it? Because in my head, I've had no consequences before. Therefore, I've just thought I'm going to go for it and just carry on down a road and route that seems to have worked for me really well in the past. Okay, I'm just going to run through a few what I would say are integral, important extra bits and pieces that you may not have considered, because I can't imagine you've considered anything if you're saying you're not guilty. I feel like I've considered quite, shut up, just shut up. Just organise those papers in an alphabetical pile whilst I explain this to you. Okay, number one, you know the rental van you stole in your name, yeah? With the chest freezer you bought in your name with a receipt that we've got in a box, yeah. With the body of the victim, with your DNA on the victim, in the box, with the handcuff key that you had in your box that we opened the handcuffs with, that were literally tethering this woman, yep. And the fact that then we went and checked out where you used to have your work and her blood was everywhere, yep. And the fact that literally all of her possessions and bloody clothing you hoarded, along with the forensic information you gathered from the reports, were all found in your house. All of them. Along with the murder weapons were in your house. Yeah, I see where you're going with this. You see where I'm going with this, yeah. You're guilty, aren't you? And as your defence, I would suggest maybe just, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go not guilty because I think I'm more superior than you are and I'm just going to risk it. I don't know whether I'm the right person for this case, you know, sir. Genuinely, can't handle it. I guess that the prosecution would have just been rubbing their hands together, wouldn't they? Because it is one of those open shut cases where you're like, please God, let me be the person trying this individual. Just list what I just said. That's where it could end. That would be all the jury would need to know. But again, what does this tell us about the mindset of this individual? Incalculably arrogant beyond belief. It's shocking and harrowing that this not right, this historical predator, this grotesque murderer, gets to hold such power and domination over this poor girl's family. Because that's what's happening, isn't it? At the end of the day, he getting his not guilty in court means that they have to live through the reality of what their absolutely adored family member had to endure. So we get to May 1997. So the murder trial commences in Orange County. Now, the prosecution argue that on the night of her disappearance, Denise had suffered a puncture, left her vehicle to get help, and then Familaro had spotted her and abducted her. And they said there's absolutely no way that she would have got into the vehicle actually voluntarily, because she wasn't very far from home. She'd just have gone to the phone box, called for help, and waited. Also, her actual wallet had a number of a taxi firm in it, and she also had a AAA roadside recovery card, so there is no way she would be leaving a vehicle. The prosecution also argued that Familaro had taken her to his warehouse where he lived, and that this is where he had raped her and murdered her, that he'd caved a skull in, he'd left this huge pool of blood at the scene, and again, it's inconceivable she would ever have voluntarily gone to this location. It's in the opposite direction of her home. They said that he had definitely kept her body as a trophy because he wanted to be reminded of the crime. And for 2 years, he'd kept it in a freezer in a lockup that he rented. Then when he'd moved to Arizona, he'd needed to take the body with him and the freezer with him. And they also said, listen, the hoarding, that was his downfall. Like I said, I would argue as well that a serial killer.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Keep mementos, so I think that's part of it as well. But certainly Mother Nature in this circumstance has certainly given him a chink in his armor. That narcissism, that hoarding, all of that, that's what's made him take the body with him. The fact that he couldn't throw anything away, that included Denise's body, her possessions, the weapons that he used to kill her, all of that he chose to keep. And all of that incriminates him immensely. We get to the 22nd of May, 1997. And the jury find him guilty of Denise's murder. I can imagine the defence were just probably thinking about what sandwich they were going to get next, because genuinely, you are not going to be in a situation, are you, where anybody with an ounce of ration, with a tiny, tiny degree of logic, is ever going to come to any other conclusion than he is massively guilty. I mean, we have seen guilty verdicts on circumstantial evidence, sometimes on circumstantial evidence that shouldn't really be there because it's so circumstantial it makes it unsound. But this one had so much forensic detail and so much evidence linking him that the idea that he ever even conceptualized he would get off with it, that makes him even more dangerous, doesn't it? Because that means that he can't even use rational thought when it comes down to the reality of what he's done and the consequences of those actions. But then maybe people like him don't really feel that consequences apply to them. Maybe people like him have such a low bar belief in women. Maybe people like him feel so justified in the degradation, humiliation, and destruction of women that they don't think other people care. And that's what motivates him psychologically, that no one's going to give a crap about a woman that he rapes and kills, because women deserve that. You get the feeling that that could also be an undercurrent that plays out here. We get to June 1997, and the jury and people in the UK and in the Western world where they don't have the death sentence may not agree with the death penalty, but I have to say, if it exists, and you're on a jury listening to this case and you're thinking about the way she died, it does not surprise me that they determined that the death sentence was appropriate. So September 1997, Familaro is sentenced to death. And what is shocking to some degree is that even though he is sentenced to death, September 1997, over a quarter of a century later, he remains on death row. So he's been being fed and watered and looked after and medically provided for the last quarter of a century. His victim didn't even get to live that long. That must be so galling for the family. He stole her life. And he's had her entire lifetime again. Yeah, on death row. And I hope it's horrible for him. I hope he's resentful and regretful every single day. And I hope it burns him and eats him up inside. But he's still breathing. Now, the California Supreme Court, they did uphold the sentence in 2011, because obviously there's like a million appeals that go through with the death penalty. And there is another appeal at the moment pending. And that means there could be further years before this is actually resolved. Also, another problem that they've got is there's currently no approved method of execution in California right now. And that means there's a chance that he'll die of old age before the sentence is legally, legitimately carried out. Although, on a positive note, should he, shall we say, take his last breaths on death row without the state punishing him and killing him that way, I do feel there'll be an immediate lift down to the depths of hell with, I don't know, a lack of chest freezers full stop, because there'll be nothing cold down there at all. Just a raging pit of hell, full of the flames that can consume you at the most intolerable of temperatures for eternity. It's just in my head. I did have some very clear pictures of this particular individual burning that way. So like I said, in this life, he may not meet his maker in the way that we would wish him to, according to the sentence, but I'm sure that the devil will have lots of pleasure and leisure with him after this. Now, bear in mind, Denise's parents had to wait 3 long years before they were even given the news that they'd been dreading. Their lives were completely destroyed with her disappearance, full stop, but also the stress that it caused. You know, both of them have suffered from ill health due to the heartbreak, due to the stress, and who wouldn't? You know, it kills people. People die of broken hearts. One of the things that is desperately sad, but also desperately beautiful, is that shortly before she was somebody who vanished into thin air, Denise had left a note stuck to her father's computer screen, and it read, "Hi, Dad. I love you. Have a great day, love, Denise." And it was signed with a happy face. Her dad later said he'd never take even $1 million for that little piece of paper, that it was priceless to him. It's something that he cherished always. They buried Denise in South Dakota. Her headstone reads, "You will always be loved." And I end it that way for a reason. Because in the midst and the depth of this unbelievable tragedy, in the horror of Denise's life being stolen in such an incomprehensibly brutal way, the one thing that never dies is love. The one thing that no one can take from that family is the memory of who she was, the impact that she had, and the relationships that were built between those bonds. And yes, at the end of the day, the family have to live with the agony of knowing that what happened to her in those final moments is beyond comprehension and something that she did not deserve in any way, shape, or form. But what remains and what will always remain are the threads of love that connect her in her dimension with them in this dimension. And one day, those threads will, without a doubt, lead them back to one another. And that is something that the killer in this case can never know. It's impossible for an individual with such malevolence and darkness in their heart to understand what true love and connection is, to understand what it's like for people to grieve you, to miss you, to value you in this life and beyond. It's just something that he'll never, ever be lucky enough to experience. And that is something that Denise and her family absolutely 100% live every single day of their lives and every single day of the life that she had until it was stolen from her. And that's a legacy like no other.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.